Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hi folks, welcome to episode 101 of the Epochs of the Loadseaters. I'm joined by Bo, and today we're going to be talking about one of my favourite subjects, the Assyrians. I love the Assyrians. We're not going to get it all done today. It's too much. Way too much. But one of my favourite things about the Assyrians is just how unrepentantly evil they are.
Yeah, they are sort of the baddies of the ancient world.
Very much so.
In a way, aren't they?
Very much so. Like, and literally everyone agrees.
And they revel in it as well, don't they?
They seem to,
they're like unapologetic. Yeah.
We are stronger than you and we're just going to come and kill you.
Yeah. Or even crossing over into the point of being sadistic.
Yeah.
Oh, like, yeah. Obviously liking their cruelty.
Glorying in it. Mm. This our ability to exact unfathomable levels of cruelty on other people is the source of our strength, prestige, and wealth.
Right.
Actually. They're quite open about it. There are loads of inscriptions. They're very literate people, left lots and lots of writings, and totally unapologetic. Mm. It's rare that you get someone who's so outright villain. I mean, literally, they're like the Sauron of the ancient Middle East. And so it's kind of, there's something kind of appealing about it to me. I'm kind of like, I don't have to live through it. So, you can enjoy it as a kind of, almost like fantasy villains, frankly.
Yeah, when things are so far removed from our world, you can just sort of kick back and just enjoy the evilness almost.
But in real life, there's a reason that, like, in the Bible, the Assyrians are cursed and the Persians are praised.
Everyone around them, they oppressed pretty badly.
And that's putting it lightly.
Yeah. So mentioning there the Bible, so just to mention straight off the bat how we know so much about, like the Akkadians and the Sumerians, they wrote loads down which survives in cuneiform, clay-baked tablets and in stone. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, as you say, they were very literate. But also Herodotus writes a bit about them, obviously long after. Well, not that long after, actually, but a few hundred years after. They show up in the Jewish Bible. Mm-hmm. We'll probably talk about that next time.
Because of all the oppression of the Jewish people that they did.
Right.
But that wasn't out of anti-Semitism. They oppressed everyone.
Yeah.
They were complete equal opportunity offenders in that regard.
And also the kingdom of Judah was supposed to pay them tribute and reneged on it.
Yeah, so that's... They destroyed Israel and subjugated Judah, didn't they?
Yeah, they didn't quite manage to take Jerusalem, but they subdued loads of it, everything apart from Jerusalem.
Well, we've got two accounts of that. One is that an angel of the Lord came down and saved the Israelites or the Jews, and the other is that they paid their taxes. That comes from the Assyrians. So I think it's likely they paid their taxes.
But anyway, that's Sennacherib. Mm. That's towards the end of the Assyrian Empire. That's just like, what, three, four generations before the end?
Yeah.
So we'll get to that next time. This is going to be a two-parter. That'll be next time.
The shadow of the Assyrians looms large over the entire Middle East for 1,000 years. It is a very terrible and terrifying thing. Mm. Like, there's just no question of it. And they are the superpower of the day as well.
Yeah, at one point, at more than one point, actually, they're the biggest empire in the world, the world had ever seen, sort of fairly easily. So to put it in its historical context, we're still talking really quite a long time ago. Well, and it spans a long time as well. Where we mentioned the Akkadian Empire had a good innings of about 180 years, well, the Assyrians do much better than that.
Oh, yeah.
But it ebbs and flows. It comes and goes a bit in its size, certainly. Its fortunes go up and down a fair bit. So let's say that. And
it's
anyway,
1,000 years, it's bound to, isn't it?
Yeah, they sort of put, and even historians break it into different bits. There's like the Neo-Assyrians, so Sennacherib and some of the Israelite or Hebrews being taken to Babylon and stuff. That's sort of the more the Neo-Assyrians. Mm. We're going to try and talk about it all. So that's why it's going to be a two-parter, because there is a fair bit to talk about. So they are the inheritors of the world of the Sumerians and the Akkadians.
Very
in,
much so.
In all sorts of ways, in most ways. I mean, for example, that their written language is cuneiform. Mm-hmm. Right there gives you a good idea. And it's the same part of the world, the exact same part of the maps I'll be putting up.
It's sort of northern Iraq.
Yeah, well, eventually their empire stretches through all of it. But yeah, it's on the Euphrates heartland. And the Tigris. Yeah. It's on the Euphrates and the Tigris. So their first most holy city is Ashur, the city of Ashur, which is on the Tigris. It's not the Euphrates. I think it's the Tigris. I should know that. Anyway, I think it's on the Tigris. But anyway, it's right there. It's right in the middle of modern-day Iraq.
And there's nothing very special about the location.
Yeah, nothing particularly special about it. Yeah. So after we mentioned last time, maybe pick up a little bit briefly what happened last time, the Akkadian Empire falling apart when the Gutians, come down out of the mountains to the east, modern-day Iran, come down and basically lay waste to the Akkadian / Sumerian Empire. And it's interesting to note, actually, and this will come up again probably in this one and the next one. It's interesting to note, really, that even the modern-day border between Iraq and Iran is sort of the same borderlands where the mountains start, really.
That's because geography demands it.
Right.
And I've long been a geographic determinist, but geography absolutely demands that's the border.
Right, yeah. It just makes perfect sense. Right. Yeah.
In the same way the border between Spain and France is at the Pyrenees. It's going to be that way.
Right. Yeah. Another quick point just to say on that then. It's interesting when you do see at various points in history completely artificial borders have been drawn.
Well, look at the Middle East now.
How badly they work nearly always.
Yeah.
Because the peoples, tribal and ethnic peoples that are there. We're like, well, that's an arbitrary line that runs straight across mountain ranges and rivers and things.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not too bad. It's okay for sort of the United States, for example, Western United States.
Where most of it is just flat. Yes.
And people aren't trying to murder each other over the odd acre here and there. Mm. But for example, in the race for Africa, where Western or British and French mainly drew borders on maps, and it hasn't worked out well. The Middle East now, I think, is a great example of that.
Yeah. Like there are states in the Middle East that should exist but don't, like Kurdistan. I do actually think that there should be a Kurdish country. You know, this doesn't make any sense that the Kurds are parceled off between like four different nations, but there we are. It's the product of some guy in London drawing maps.
Yeah, or in Paris.
In Paris, yeah.
I mean, modern-day Iraq is a creation.
Yeah.
It came sort of after Versailles.
Yeah.
Really.
As I understand it, Iraq is etymologically linked to Uruk.
Oh, the word?
Yeah, the word.
Oh, right. Yeah,
so
yeah,
you can see that this is not like a natural thing that's come about, right? It seems very artificial in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, after World War One or before World War One, there was still Mesopotamia.
Yeah,
and then I mentioned, seemingly can't ever help but mention Lawrence of Arabia, Lawrence of Arabia, and the man that he promoted to be one of the most important people in the Middle East, Faisal, King Faisal the First. They made him king of Iraq in the early 20s, and they divided up. There was a Transjordan, and they made. Anyway, it was all sort of, it's really fairly artificial.
Yeah.
And from the early 20th century. Mm. Anyway, getting slightly off the point there. So the city of Ashur, it's just in the middle there. It's basically in the middle.
Yeah. So again, it's been a few years since I've read about it. But as I recall, basically, it's very old. And it goes back into the sort of like, you know, the deep history of the region. Presumably was an area where nomads pitched up tents. And eventually just sort of started building stuff. It's got an old king list, goes back way, like the Sumerians, you know, very much copying the Sumerians. We've got our king list where for 25,000 years there was this one king, and then we start getting more reasonable about it. But it seems that it was just a convenient place for a bunch of nomads to start building actual buildings.
Yeah.
There's nothing special about it at all.
Yeah. There's nothing special other than, nothing very special about it.
It's compared to the other cities in the region.
Yeah. So just all up and down by sort of, the 13th, 14th century BC, the Tigris and Euphrates are just dotted with cities and settlements all up and down.
Yeah. And when we call them cities, not necessarily very big, not what we would call like cities.
from the Persian Gulf
yeah.
all the way up to, well, modern day Mosul and beyond.
Yeah, it's a very well populated region.
And Asher, to begin with, yeah, there's no particular reason why that would end up, what you would guess if you went yeah. back in time, that would end up as the centre of some sort of, well, the greatest empire the world had seen at that point. Mm. And anyway, that's where the Assyrians actually, again, get their name from etymologically.
Yeah.
If I said that word correctly, correct. just about. It comes from Asher. And another thing quick to say, I think we mentioned it in one of the last ones, maybe one about the Sumerians. This idea that each city had a god, mm. usually by the same name, and in this case it was. There's the god Asher as mm. well. And at the top of your ziggurat would be your sort of most central, most holy temple. And
with an idol.
With an idol, an actual yeah. physical statue of your god.
Mm.
And the city and the god became one in all sorts of ways.
Yeah.
The god Asher and the city Asher are one and the same, and their fortunes are one and the same. Mm. If the city's doing well and is prosperous, the god has done that for you.
And not just that, the god's status in the hierarchy of the divine pantheon goes up. Because, mm. mm. I mean, one of the things that was incredibly common in pagan Middle Eastern warfare, and they all did this, is when one city conquered another, they would take the idol of their god, proceed it back to the thing,
and then
lay it at the feet of the idol of their god. Here's a ritual humiliation for you. Our god has conquered your god, and you know this. And yes, this is, and don't get me wrong, there's something kind of quaint about it. There's something like, yeah, why not? I can see the logic, you know? It's like, no, you are right. So I kind of agree with them on that for some reason.
If you buy into the conceit of the thing, it makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
You kidnap
it.
It's like, I've got your god.
Yeah.
How do you like me now?
Yeah.
What are you going
to
do now?
Our god empowered us to do this to you.
Mm.
You know, your god's weak.
Mm.
I can completely see the logic.
And you're right that, if you're, and also if you're defeated in battle, you know, it's like your god has been defeated.
Mm.
In all sorts of ways, and one of the main gods, or the main god, sort of from the old Akkadian Sumerian days, Enlil was sort of quite often thought of as the chief god.
Mm.
And I'm jumping ahead here, but just to say on that point, Asher, when Asher becomes the center of the Assyrian Empire, Asher sort of becomes the head god.
Mm.
Sort of change their theology a bit and say that, no, it wasn't Enlil. Asher is actually the main one, the top dog.
But it's interesting because the gods themselves have aspects, as it were. And Enlil is a sky god. He's some sort of heavenly god. So it makes sense that in the absence of warfare, you'd be like, okay, well, he's like the top god or something like that. And so you see that Asher takes on aspects of some sort of solar divinity, like the sun, the winged sun with the bow, the bowman in the sun is a representation of Asher that they use during the supremacy. And so it's interesting how, I mean, Asher's obviously a warrior god for whatever reason. He's never not depicted with a bow. So he's a warrior god who, through the ascendancy of Assyria as a state, is essentially kind of conscripted into the oppressions. Okay, we've got to give him all these other trappings now to show that he's a solar divinity.
Mm, mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Well, that's one of the things to mention where he's nearly always, depicted with a bow and arrow.
Yeah.
So that feeds into one of the main sort of themes of the Assyrians right away, is that they are militaristic.
Yes.
They are, as we said right at the beginning, hinted at, they're violent.
To be honest,
they're not a pacifist people.
No. To be honest with you, there's a lot of Rome I see in Assyria, actually.
Mm.
Like this same kind of will to power that is, and the same sort of geographic determinism that seems to like lay on them. It's like, you know, you're the Romans. Really, you can be invaded by any of your neighbours any time if you're the early Romans. You know, you don't even stretch to the coast. You know, so you've got to really want to win all of these things. And the Assyrians are in the same sort of position. They can be invaded from practically anywhere. And if they want to be, you know, a sovereign people, they've really got to work for this. And a lot of people did try to, you know, conquer and kill them throughout the course of Assyria's life. So you can kind of see how they were molded into what they became. And it was just, you know, the sort of the hard eye where they were like, no, we're going to do this. You know, so there's a part of me that admires that, to be honest, even though they are phenomenally evil.
Yeah. In a world where might is right,
yes,
there's something to say for someone that does it well then. If that's the world you live in, then okay, they're not failures.
No, they're completely, they're the most successful empire probably in all of history, actually.
It's an interesting point you make, actually, with parallels with Rome.
Yeah.
There's many more than that, even.
I know.
Even in sort of the military, the things they do in military, in the military sphere, there's quite a lot of parallels with Rome. The engineers and things, getting serious about logistics and all sorts of stuff.
Absolutely. The Assyrian engineering is literally second to none until the Romans stand up. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about the Assyrians, they're like what Rome would have become without Greek influence. If Rome wasn't next to Greece, or Greece didn't really exist, then the Romans would probably not have become a republic, right? They probably wouldn't have had the political philosophy to become a republic. Where would these ideas have come from? I doubt the Romans would have thought of them themselves, right? Not to get down on the Romans, but they were never great philosophers. I think that that's an influence of Greece. And the Assyrians long predate the Greeks as we know them, and the Greek city-states of the classical era. So they are essentially like, what happens if the truly archaic ideas are allowed to just essentially flourish on their own? And what you get is this giant evil empire. It's quite magnificent in a way. It's demonic, but it's also kind of dark majesty. It has.
Because in all sorts of ways, the Romans are like an evil empire. You can make that argument. If you're on the other side of the ledger to them, they would seem completely demonic.
Well, who was it that said they make a desert and call it peace? Was it Josephus or something?
Who said that? It's a very famous line, isn't
it? Was
it
a Roman.
I can't remember who said it.
Who said it? Because they were like, we're kind of evil.
Yeah, we the baddies. Was it Tacitus? I can't
remember
who said
Tacitus,
it.
I thought it was Josephus in the Jewish
world. It might be. But I can't remember. It's such a famous quote.
It's one of those things that you should know where it comes from. Yeah. But I mean, look at it from the Gallic perspective. You know, if a third of Gaul has been murdered and a third enslaved and a third colonized essentially out of existence, it's hard to not see them as like a tyrannical evil empire. It's a fair assessment. And the Assyrians essentially are very much the same, actually.
Yeah. Assyrians and the Romans, also, a lot of it based on slavery as well, to prop
Completely.
It up. So there's also that element to it. We've said before, there's actually all different degrees or stripes of severity of slavery. And this and the Romans, it's a pretty bad one.
Yeah.
Sort of, it's not a light touch indentured type slavery, serfdom type thing. It's full blown, often.
Well,
the full blown slavery.
Yeah, okay. So let's. It depends who you are and what time period you live in, right? Because a lot of the early Assyrian Empire was essentially just a giant organized mafia, where this big army of farmers who have picked up weapons would come along to your city and say, "Give us money, and if you don't give us money, we're going to sack your city." And so a lot of it was just tributary, really. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't even have had direct governance over places. But that doesn't persist, and then it does take on the sort of administrative state that Rome develops as well. So it depends when. You could be a subject people that just has to pay taxes and, you know, supply, you know, 10,000 men or something. And it's not the end of the world, but you could be literally taken off into bondage if you told them no, because the Assyrians didn't take no for an answer.
And also, people that know their stuff out there might roll their eyes at what I just said, especially about the Romans, because there are many degrees of it.
You could be
working in the salt mines of Numidia as a slave.
You could be a tutor to an aristocrat's son.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you're treated very, very well, actually. Yeah. And then you get your freedom.
Because you earned it.
And then you have a private fortune of your own and on. Yeah. So slavery could be very, very light touch in the Roman world. Depends where you were at what time and all sorts of things. So just to make that clear, I am aware.
Yeah. But it's probably not fun for most people.
Right, yeah. Well, that was the thing. A lot of the time,
especially
out in the provinces. What was the big island? Was it Cyprus or... not Cyprus. There was one massive slaver island the Romans had.
Sicily or Crete, is it?
I think it was Crete.
Right.
The whole thing was like a hub for slaving.
Right, right.
And that some descriptions of that seem hellish.
So there was a massive slave revolt in Sicily as well.
Right.
So there must have been loads of slaves in Sicily. So,
But we're getting off the point slightly. Just go back to the Assyrians specifically. I want to place them in their time. So to begin with, it's sort of the pre-Bronze Age collapse.
Yes.
Which is roughly somewhere between 1200 and 1150 BC. Somewhere around then we get the Sea Peoples and we see the Bronze Age collapse and that whole thing.
And
they straddle both sides of it.
Yeah.
So I want to say that first.
No, this is a great point because... From the sort of collapse of the Akkadian Empire about 2000 BC to about 1100 BC, the Assyrians have a contiguous civilization. It's not very important. It's like a minor regional kingdom.
Yeah, that's right.
But it is intact and it lasts. It's you know, as I said, contiguous. It's not interrupted by a foreign invasion or anything like this. And the Assyrians are competing with, just as a very brief overview of the Bronze Age civilizations, you have what they call like giant palace civilizations. So it's a very centralized bureaucratic civilization around the divine king and his essentially resource accumulation in the palace. And we see this in like Egypt, Hattusha, Assyria, Babylon, Crete in the Minoans, and probably something similar in the Mycenaean areas of Greece. And for reasons that historians are still divided over, but I'm pretty convinced, I'm certain it's just going to be some sort of the Dorian invasions or something like this. You know, the
Sea Peoples.
Yeah. Right. They
seem to have come from the west.
We've
got a whole epoch in this, haven't we?
We do. Ramses III is, you know, it's a conspiracy in their isles. Well, it's the Aegean Sea. So it's a bunch of warrior Greeks. And I think that the Iliad is basically the cultural memory that the Greeks have of taking part in these things. But they essentially ravaged everything within range and destroyed civilizations. And the only civilizations, just to very, very briefly rush you through the Bronze Age collapse, there's a very advanced, prior to this, there's a very advanced economic set of economic activity going on. There's lots of trade in copper and in textiles and things like this that goes, copper and tin and textiles, that goes from Britain, Afghanistan to the Middle East, bringing these resources across this entire area. And this requires, this is where the invention of writing comes from, is to make sure that we keep track of things like that. And so you get a level of civilization that starts growing up. And it seems that the, whatever we're going to call the proto-Greeks, are barbarian raiders, pirates at this point, and have hit on a technology that allows them to do this. Now, you've seen the Mycenaean armor. I can't remember I can't remember what it's called. The panoply.
Well, it looks like a Ned Kelly type.
Yeah,
thing.
Where it's literally bands of bronze. I'm sure we can get a picture up in post. But this seems like a remarkable innovation in armor, and it probably worked really well actually in the Bronze Age. And I'm guessing it was this armor that allowed them to conduct terrifying raids and destroy. Literally, because if the archaeology shows that the entire sort of eastern or western seaboard of the Middle East, the eastern seaboard of the Mediterranean, it's just burned down just over the course of like 100 years. And the only civilizations that seem to have resisted this are the Egyptians and the Assyrians. And the Assyrians, probably because they're too far away to be able to sail over and give them hell. So fortunately, their geography saved them there. But the Egyptians actually seem to have defeated them in battle. And Ramses III, I think it was.
Yeah.
So this leads to a wide-scale economic collapse and the sort of new Dark Age. And it's out of this Dark Age that classical civilization in the West appears. But the Assyrians survive this Dark Age. They're one of the few cultures to do so. And actually, it turns out that a massive vacuum of power, we should do epochs at some point on the Hittites, because they're another terrifying civilization. They're a terrifying civilization who have got very much the Assyrian ethos towards life and war and conquest, because everyone did. Everyone had the same ethos. So the Assyrians for their time weren't anything remarkable. They were really the ones that just were fortunate enough to be well-placed to deal with it, it seems. Have I got that right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, all of that, right? We just don't know who the sea peoples were. It's more than one people. The Egyptians say it was seven peoples. They do seem to have come from the west. It's a totally good call to say they may well have been Greek.
Not just Greek, not, as I say. Right, it's like it's going to be a coalition of barbarian tribes that have come down, probably from the north, arrived in Greece, and realized that actually this is a great staging point to raid the vast and wealthy civilizations of the East. Because it was.
Right, yeah. But whoever they were, they were sort of apocalyptic in their in the totality of the destruction they wrought.
Yeah.
The archaeology just sees almost everything is laid waste.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Totally ruthless.
Yeah.
And the and again, I don't want to give the Hittites short shrift here, because the Hittites were a massive and professional empire. They had phenomenally good soldiers. They had an incredible military tradition in the Hittite Empire. So if the Sea Peoples can trash them, they can trash anyone, basically.
Yeah, so the Hatti, the Hittites from modern-day Turkey, had a fairly decent empire going on.
It was massive.
And that gets completely trashed.
Yeah. We've got archaeological records from the Hittites where they explain their military doctrines. For example, if you're a sergeant or some officer and you don't do as you're told, you get executed. Like, it's unbelievably strict. But that meant that their army was very, very, very good. But of course it had to be, because they had to compete with the Assyrians and the Egyptians and the whatever we're going to call the people living in Armenia at the time. You know, they're surrounded by great powers, basically.
Yeah, yeah. So the people surrounding the Assyrians were sort of, the Aramaeans, the Hittites, the Babylonians to their south. The Mushku are people, quite important, big people called the Mushku. And the Egyptians, obviously, the Egyptians were... So, yeah, and the only ones that seem to survive this onslaught of the Sea Peoples, the Bronze Age collapse, seems to be the Egyptians by the skin of their teeth.
Mm.
And the Assyrians, also by the skin of their teeth, though.
Yeah.
Even though they're a long way away, effectively, if the epicenter of it was on the Levant, they're quite a long way from it. But they had a bit of an empire going on, and it totally shrinks. Yeah. They have to turtle up. They have to do everything they possibly can to just sort of weather it.
Yeah.
And they do just about.
And the thing as well we've got to remind people is there is always the prospect of just random barbarian invasions. Mm. Like, this happens a lot to the Assyrians. It happened to the Akkadians. Well, you know, just this random barbarian tribe turns up and they kill everyone. It's brilliant.
The Iranian mountains are still full of savages.
Yeah, but you can come down from the Caucasus as the Sumerians. And so it's like you've just got it's a very difficult area to survive in, because people can come from anywhere. And you don't want people coming from Central Asia to wherever you are, because the people in Central Asia are always awful. Like, awful. Like, not just barbaric, but insanely tough. And this just, again, every single people that comes out of the cauldron of nations is just like iron. You know, they're just beaten into the hardest and most unforgiving shape. And it's so right, okay.
Like Scythians or Mongols.
Yeah, or the Sumerians or the Huns or whoever. It keeps happening, you know. And it's so when I'm like, the Assyrians were evil. For a given level of evil, right?
Right, yeah.
Like, they were evil for us in liberal democracies in England in the 21st century. But, there are times where the Assyrians are like the saviours of the Middle East. Mm. So, you know, it's better the devil you know, I suppose.
Yeah, they're no more or less evil than the Mongols.
Well, I would say they're less evil than the Mongols.
Right. They're just among the first, that's the thing, isn't it? They're sort of among the first, because we are still talking, you know, 1000 BC plus.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think, say, where I mentioned they straddle the Bronze Age collapse. Before the Bronze Age collapse, there's a long period between the fall of Akkad and the Bronze Age collapse. And you said they were sort of continuous, and absolutely. During those centuries, I have to montage through it a little bit, but during those centuries, their the amount of land that Ashur controlled gets bigger and smaller. Yeah. And Babylon sometimes subjugate them for a while. Yep. And then sometimes they sort of gain their independence again. Mm. And then the Aramaeans or somebody might come, or the Hittites might come along and subjugate them to some degree.
Or at least take large amounts of their territory. And it's a continual bickering, essentially, it feels like.
And so in that period, the Assyrians never sort of get massive as they do afterwards.
No, they have a substantial kingdom and are competent at managing it.
So they've been around for a long time by the end of the Bronze Age collapse. Mm. And it is very, very, very interesting, I think, fascinating. Most people think it's interesting to note that they totally still had all the cultural, historical memory of the Akkadians and the Sumerians. The name of Sargon the Great was on their lips, was in their mind.
Yeah.
They still told stories about Gilgamesh and Sargon, which was like, 1,500 years more before.
I mean, they view themselves as the inheritors of the Akkadian Empire.
Right.
But they are absolutely in exactly the same location with almost exactly the same cultural inheritance. Mm. Like,
it's just,
you can't
it's
say that
great,
they're not.
Isn't it?
It's brilliant. Yeah.
It's amazing that they managed to keep it alive, if you like. Because if they hadn't, all that stuff would almost certainly be lost, would have thought.
Mm.
Another quick note to mention, where I said in the modern day you've got the modern borders between Iraq and Iran. The difference between northern and southern Mesopotamia, where you had the Sumerians and the Akkadians, later you've got the Assyrians and the Babylonians, pretty much the exact same sort of divide.
Yeah.
And even today, the Sunni and the Shia in Iraq, it's the same thing, because Basra down in the south is very different to Baghdad.
I bet.
I mean, it, literally the Sunni-Shia schism thing.
Mm.
It's
very interesting.
The ripples of history, or the way history repeats itself, or there's echoes of it.
I think it shows us the importance of ethnic inheritance, though. These things draw their own boundaries, right? There's no getting around it. You know, it's what parents teach to their children and what communities agree upon culturally. You can see this, if you were to overlay them one over another, they're very, very, very similar. And so it must be something to do with that lineal sort of process through time.
Mm.
Mm. To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.